always a problem. That's why the use of the letters H and N seem to be neutral. Okay? So you'll hear a lot of that rather than the other. That's the name. And we've had different serotypes at different times. Our current concern is H5N1. We'll get to that in a moment. We have some definitions which we are important to understand because, again, the general public sometimes confuses them and has drawn the wrong conclusions. Epidemic, local cluster, that could be a county, that could be a country. Pandemic is worldwide epidemic. Neither of those terms refer to the number of deaths involved. General assumption of the general public is that a pandemic is more people dying. Certain percentage of people who are infected die, and the number of infected increase, then the number who die increase, but it's not directly related to the number who die. The word pandemic talks about disease throughout the world. The World Health Organization, also what that means, has a great concern about the level of alert that they have to send out. They have, like, what we have, the security alerts, different colors they have, and the numbering system. And as they would raise the people of the world to alert, they were concerned about the panic that might result. The panic is a concern. The public needs to understand good information in a timely manner. And if they get the wrong information, the timing is not good, then we can get panic. And panic means, in many cases, crowded emergency rooms, emergency departments, kinds of elbowing one another out to get a vaccine or something, whether they're eligible for it or appropriate for them, or not important. Same thing with hoarding of drugs, hoarding of Tamiflu and so on. People buy stocks, they have friends who know somebody, and they keep 300 or 500 units tucked away in the bedroom or something. And that's certainly not an appropriate way to do things. So when people panic, then bad things happen, and somebody will die if they don't get panic. Plus, when we have a whole bunch of people who are thinking they are sick, okay, but walking well, who think they are sick, who go to the emergency room, then crowd them, which make it harder to triage. That is, how do you find the actual sick person amongst the extra 30 people in the room who aren't sick, who think they are? That takes time. That takes money. And that sort of thing is not something you want to waste, neither time nor money, when we have an emergency. So trying to keep the people who don't belong in the emergency room out is also part of that public awareness. And of course, then we have the difficulty of treating people because they're being crowded together in an emergency room and most of them don't need to be there at all, and they're infecting one another in the hospital. So they came, first of all, worried well, but then they leave actually infected. All of these things are consequences of the public's misperception of what's going on. So as a person who will be in direct contact with the public, we need to be able to give them timely and correct information. So know about those terms, epidemic, pandemic, and so on. Antigenic shift and drift. This is how the changes come about. The drift is a result of a point mutation. And it's why we have seasonal flu. Bless you. I think you've been your elbow. I didn't bless you. No, you didn't do it. The people around me should know. The antigenic shift is different than a drift. And the antigenic shift is the reassortment. And they come about with a different periodicity. Again, the shift is the major changes. And they come about every 8 to 12 years. The antigenic drifts are gradual and result in increased numbers every 2 years, 2 to 4 years, although they do result in the actual changes every year. But there's a significant change in 3 or 4 years if we actually have an increase in numbers of infection. And notice that it's not protected by the annual vaccine, that is the antigenic shift. That's why this year we have, guess what, 2 vaccines to deal with. A variety of different kinds of pandemics throughout the 20th century. 1918 is the benchmark. That was a lot of number of deaths. And notice there was also an H1N1, a are experiencing now. The naming of the flu, again, we talked about concerns about that. Blaming somebody for it is always not a good thing. So we're moving more towards the scientific H's and N's, which is probably a good thing. Now, when we have a significant number of deaths, the mechanism of virulence of the virus is different than when we have the seasonal flu. So that means we'll see different populations at risk due to different types of weapon systems that the organism may have. And we'll come about more discussion of that in a moment. And again, this is just another description of the various kinds of isolates. The people who discovered it first didn't name it first, and that's why they're named after places. This over 20 million, we mentioned last time, that's a very crude estimate. Other estimates go 50 million to 100 million. There was just no good way of knowing why all the people were dying, because they were dying so fast and so spread around the world, it was hard to get a good accounting. We really don't know how many people died. And also, they're attributed to the death of the influenza when they had a super infection, right, or a secondary infection to the bacterial in origin. So it begins as a viral, then switches to a bacterial, and many of those people die of the bacterial infection as well. So there's a mixture of things that are going on there when you talk about the number of deaths. Typically, for the seasonal flu, what we see is a movement from Asia to the rest of the world. The reason for that has to do with bird migration and concentration of people and animals close together. As the birds migrate from the Arctic down all the way to New Zealand, they are landing at various places. And the birds are infected with the same agent that we become infected with, or a very similar one. These migratory birds then infect local populations of ducks, chickens and so on, they in turn infect humans. That's the typical pattern. So we have a high concentration of migratory birds and other birds that then move into the population. That will change a little bit as Asia, Southeast Asia and so on gradually becomes more electrified and they have such things as refrigerators more commonly in use. That means that they don't need to buy the chicken alive. They can go into a supermarket and get frozen chicken like the rest of the world. The fact that they're buying living chickens, and these living chickens are housed with one another before they're sold, so you would have to buy them maybe a meter by meter by meter size, cubic meter, and there may be 20 or 30 or more birds like this. They're not flapping their wings. There's no bird protection group that says they need exercise and water, and they're just crammed right in there. And as a result, these birds are stressed, they're infected, they infect one another, and then they infect the people that work for the birds, and then they infect the people who take them home, and so on. So the interaction with living, infected birds with humans is a significant worldwide mechanism by which we have the spread of the seasonal varieties. Now, there is a difference between the common cold, influenza, and something serious like the H1N1 of 1918 or the potential outbreak of the human bird flu or avian flu. So we're going to make a distinction between those three. And it's upon those three that a large number of people will be triaged. So we actually have a major epidemic of something like the bird flu, the avian influenza. You will probably be called in your local area, so you'll be pulled out of Meijer or someplace, and then you'll be pulled into the parking lot someplace at a hospital, and they will be testing people before they even get into the hospital itself. And you may be involved in that, so you need to know the difference. Of course, we already talked about the common cold kind of thing. That's the runny nose and the sore throat. Generally, you don't have a fever. Generally, your appetite is pretty much normal. Generally, you don't have aches and pains. So basically, you've got a runny nose and a sore throat, and maybe your eyes tear up or something. That's the common cold. We compare that to influenza. We see we have a fever, and there you hear lots of talk about fever. Now, we'll learn a little later when we talk about the immune system and dissect that aspect of our body. We'll find that fever is actually a mechanism of the immune response. So if you have an otherwise healthy immune system, it will trigger a fever. But that also means that since it's not necessarily a direct activity of the virus, but rather our response to the virus, patients who are immunocompromised, AIDS patients, transplant patients receiving immunosuppressive therapy and so on, those patients will not necessarily demonstrate as much of a fever or maybe no fever at all. So as much as we want to put a note on that fever aspect of influenza, and that's true for the general population, it may not be true of an AIDS patient or an immunosuppressed patient and so on. Again, it's part of our immune response. If the immune response is not functioning normally, then you may not demonstrate a fever. So that's an important thing to know. Patient history, putting the signs and symptoms in new context is always extremely important. Again, signs and symptoms. Sign is what someone sees in some other person. Symptom is what they are complaining of. You cannot see the sore throat, but they can tell you they have one. So we have a fever, typically associated, but not always. A cough. This is going to be a rather, a pronounced cough, not just a she coughs once. Now, you may cough again because you mentioned it, but generally speaking, coughing, sneezing, just a little bit, that's not what we're talking about. These are just a repeated hacking cough that when they cough, because they also have some degree of the lining of the brain involved, when they cough, they see stars, and it's just, wah, It's just, they're coughing, their brain is shaking, and that's just, it's a painful cough in terms of what it does to your head when you're coughing. You have a sore throat. You have a very nasty headache. We talk about headaches in the common cold, but you may have a sinus infection when you have a common cold, and that might give you a headache, so that's sort of it. But this headache is, again, when you're coughing and you've got this headache, you literally sort of see stars when you're coughing. Malaise, you don't feel like doing anything. This is not like, I don't think I'm going to do a green micro this weekend. I think I'm going to watch the Michigan play this weekend. Penn State, I'm going to get a good team. Hey, last week was like a week off. And then they got another one from, they play the Toledo's on the Rockets or something. I think they're going to do Penn State, that'll give them a little bit of time. So don't feel like doing anything except watching Michigan play Penn State. That's malaise. No. Malaise is when you can't get out of bed. Okay? I mean, this is, you are flat on your back. You have no interest in doing anything. Turning in your bed is a major decision to be made. Okay? Your cover is off your shoulders, but that's too much effort to pull it up over your ears. That's what we're talking about. This is not like, maybe I'll do my own. No, it's not. It's malaise. Anorexia means you're not eating. Photophobia, that's the signing of the lining of the brain being inflamed. Okay, so bright lights bother you, sunlight coming into the room. The light going on in the middle of the night, people wander to the bathroom and throw up, which is another thing you would have, vomiting. Okay. Not listed there, but you might have it. You may have diarrhea. The vomiting and diarrhea are sort of possible, common, but not in every case. Joint and muscle pain. This is not like a little ache. Make it a little sore. No. This is an ache gone to a pain. It hurts to move. Coupled with the malaise, you don't want to move at all. You may have some respiratory signs, but it's not usually a major phenomenon. That will be a distinction with the avian influenza. Rarely do we see anything serious wrong with your ability to breathe. Well, listen to your lungs, and everything should be reasonably okay. And with a typical influenza, the severe or fatal forms occur with the elderly population over the age of 65. And since we see that, we really need to think of all those people who are at risk for respiratory tract problems we talked about before. Chronic lung disease, bronchitis. This would also include asthmatic. children and infants at risk. And then chronic diseases such as diabetes and so on. Now, they're at risk for this situation because of their immune system and their predisposing weakness. Okay? So over the age of 65, the immune system is not as good as it should be. We talked about the extremes of age before. Well, that's all we got, infants and children. Okay? And typically, that is up to about 3 months to 5 years of age, young children. Now, that's the typical situation that would be more severe or fatal illness. What we're seeing in the current influenza, H1N1, I was talking to one of my sons who works in the health profession, and in the hospital he was seeing people and such, and said more people are dying on television than they are in the streets, meaning that all we need is a few people dying, and of course that's going to make the news. And when you really have a lot of time on the news, like the cable news networks and things, when you have 24-hour news, they have a lot of time to fill up. So they will zero in on Sarah Smith, who's dying of influenza. And there's nothing to take away from Sarah Smith who's dying of influenza. Yes, that's a possibility. And we look at those children who are dying, because it makes good news. We look at children that are dying. Most of the time, we've been able to nail down some extra feature about that child that puts them at risk as compared to the normal child. But that does create the panic among the parents who think their child is also just as at risk as Sarah was. In fact, that's not the case. But most of these children that we see, and these are children of a variety of ages, if you notice, there'll be children that are teenagers and children who are 5 years old and so on. Most of these children have, when you go with me and get all the information, we can discover some specific immunodeficiency that they have that puts them at risk. That doesn't answer all the questions, but that answers most of those questions. Now, the current influenza is a little bit different than the normal one. And we don't know why. Well, there's some differences we don't understand. For example, the typical influenza is going to be a little later in the year. We'll start seeing some cases in November and December on the typical seasonal flu. And we'll see a peak of that in January and February. And then gradually it'll disappear by March and April. That's the typical pattern for influenza. And though when we have two immunizations out there now, the seasonal flu, that people were able to get a hold of first, the production system, which we'll refer to in detail later, but this seasonal flu immunization, that one, which you may have already, how many people already have the seasonal flu shot? Not a lot. That's out, okay? You can get that. That's not going to protect you against H1N1 because that isn't here yet in any great number. The vast majority of the ones we have right now are the H1N1, the swine flu problem. So it's not the normal season. That's the first thing we know about it. We don't know why. Okay. It also began a little later last year, if you recall, the problems around the end by finals. Okay. And that's not when the normal flu is. So it's sort of out of sync temporally. It hit us last year in April, May, June. It lingered throughout the United States. It lingered throughout the summer. There were variety cases of summer camp and things like that. But typically the virus, when the weather is warm, is not a problem. The virus, pan more by pan epidemic, causes more problems in the southern hemisphere because they're having a winter then. Okay, so we expected to see a greater shift in Buenos Aires and Brazil and so on, and less of a problem here, but we still saw it lingering. So this, the epidemiology is a little different with this virus, the timing of the year. Another aspect about this H1N1 that's a little different, but it's not creating death in great numbers, is that it is more infectious. It seems to spread a little easier. We don't know why. But the fatalities, we don't think it's going to be as serious as the normal flu. Now, the normal flu, again, the one that will be coming about, the seasonal flu that is not here yet, that will be here in a few months and then continue on until the beginning of next semester and then gradually fade away as the semester goes on. That seasonal one kills off around 35,000 Americans every year. Now, that's a lot of people, but people don't seem to get all bent out of shape about it because it's not in the news. You have to understand the value and the importance and the distortion that comes about with news. It's just like if you get a brand new car and it's a purple car. Nobody has purple cars. If you wanted a unique car, got a purple car, and you drive around your purple car and all you see is a purple car. Everybody got one now. Okay? Your perception has changed. And perception can twist data and twist the reality. So that's what we're seeing in terms of the concern about the number of deaths. But 35,000 normally in a seasonal flu, we may have maybe double that this year. You should have got two flus. But that does not make this particular flu particularly fatal. It is infecting more people, but it doesn't seem to be killing off people at this point in time. And we're right in the midst of it. You'll notice the school, what's the local news, schools are closing down for several days and so on. We haven't seen that in Ferris yet, but there have been outbreaks. If you've gone to the health map, if you go to healthmap.org, you can get all kinds of current information. I mentioned that already, I think, did I not? Health map. Right. So what they're basically doing with that system is they've got a computerized review of all worldwide electronic information. So there's an automated way of reviewing the news. They gather all the information, and it can be then prioritized, analyzed, and put up on the screen and tabulated in a matter of minutes sometimes, certainly hours, which makes that about 5 days more efficient in terms of getting it faster than we see with the typical CDC announcements and so on. So it's a good system. So here we have, that's the typical influenza. The avian influenza, the bird flu, which is much more like the 1918 thing, is not here yet. First thing, we don't have it yet. But when it happens, and it has happened occasionally, where it crosses over from human, from animals into humans, we have all that you have in front of you, that is, you have fever and cough and sore throat and headache and lodge and so on. But in addition, we have a rapidly progressing severe pulmonary problem, meaning that within 2 to 4 days of the onset of symptoms, the person is going to need to be put on a respirator. And this is much like the 1918 phenomenon. So what we have right now is not the 1918 problem. It's an H1N1, yes, but it doesn't carry those extra added virulence factors that trigger a strong inflammatory response, an immune response in the lungs. The lungs fill up with fluid, and the person drowns in their own juices, so to speak. And they have to be put on a respirator. That is where most of the people die. So that's a factor. The other factor is this strong inflammatory response we sometimes call a cytokine shower. A cytokine is nothing more than a cell signal. If the cell signal is coming from lymphocytes, it's called a lymphocyte, and so on. But a cytokine shower is a normal mechanism of protection now in an exaggerated sense. So we have too much of a good thing, too strong of an immune response, triggered as a weapon system by the organism. In retrospect, remember, lipid A did a similar sort of thing. Lipid A activates your immune response to cause problems. That's what's happening with avian influenza, and that's what happened with H1N1 of the 1918 epidemic. And when that happens, then, we see a different population at risk. If your immune system is really strong, then you can produce a strong cytokine shower, and then you can die quicker. So unlike the seasonal flu, where we have the extremes of age being at risk because their immune system is weakened, in this setting, we have essentially the opposite. If your immune system is weakened, then you really can't come back with a strong cytokine shower. But if you are a strong, otherwise healthy person, you are now at risk. So the data is just split. And then we see people who are in their teens and 20s and early 30s being at the greatest risk. In 1918, more soldiers died because of the flu than died of combat injuries or combat-related deaths. They were the healthy people. They were the 18, 22-year-old soldiers that were dying. And they were dying quickly, 4 days without a respirator. You're toast. So when it comes to this particular problem, it's a different set of people at risk. We don't see that now. Now the good news is that the carryover into humans has been so fatal that those outbreaks which have occurred have wiped out the population to the extent that it doesn't spread to other people. So it crosses over from animals to humans, wipe out a bunch of people, and then disappears. Fatality rates someplace between 60 and 80%, depending upon the different outbreak. So those outbreaks, they may go off, 8 people in one cluster or 27 people in another cluster. I mean, 27 is a higher one, but most of them are small numbers of people. And then that's it, disappears. The 1918 had an infection rate, or a fatality rate, not an infection rate, but a fatality rate someplace around 2%. So infected, or killed 2% of the people that infected. That allows it to spread around the world. Now, if you think about that, that's why our numbers are so high. It has the characteristics of the current H1N1 with respect to infectivity, but it was also lethal. This one has got the infectivity higher than a normal flu, we think. It takes a lot more data. But we think it's a little more infectious than others. We'll analyze that in more detail over time. But the current H1N1, it seems to be more infectious than the typical kind of seasonal flu. So we'll have more people involved with the problem. But it is not lethal at the level of the 2% level. So they are different. So if someone comes and you're doing triage, if you're doing the avian influenza problem, and they have a fever and they have a cough, but their lung sounds are fine, they don't have any difficulty breathing, their respiration rate is normal, they're not labored in any sense of breathing, then chances are they don't have the critical problem that we need to triage and get them into the hospital. They don't need a respirator. And we've had several mock-up tests to see if we're prepared throughout the state, throughout the country, throughout the world. And in general, we're not prepared. And one of the reasons why we're not prepared is we don't have nearly enough respirators to go around. So there will be people who will be hoarding respirators. This respirator is like a ventilator kind of machine. It's not the mask that we're talking about. And so that's going to be a problem. The use of an antiviral drug, like Tamiflu and so on. We have no clue whether or not, if or when the avian influenza comes around and starts killing off great numbers of people, we have no idea what the viral effectiveness will be, the antiviral effectiveness will be. And there are varieties every year that are resistant to Tamiflu or whatever we might use. One of the concerns we have right now is the massive use of Tamiflu in this current problem, which will maybe select for resistance that could be passed on to the true bug, which might be coming around next. That's the avian influenza. So, yeah, it's the antibacterial. The more we use an antiviral, the more we select for resistance. So we can see a difference between a runny nose and a sore throat and clogged nose, difficulty nasal breathing, clogged nose. That's one thing. That's not the flu. That's just a common cold. Most people walking in the streets that haven't had a microplastic, that could be the flu. It's not. And then we have the actual flu, which is what's going around with the muscle aches and the fever and so on. And then we have then avian influenza. The difference between the last two is the involvement of the lungs, a rapid deterioration of lung function, resulting in death. Now, how can this be the normal kind of thing? We have migratory birds that we talked about. And and we have it spread to domestic birds, and we have it spread to humans. You see the whole situation. And there's a variety of these various things that we see. I just wanted to dock stuff over here, but the idea is perhaps we've got peace in the document. Well, we've got one hinky dock stuff, we don't need to memorize this one. Notice the symbol here is the same symbol. Reassortment. This is a segmented virus. That means it has several different components of the RNA. And you can shuffle the deck. That's called reassortment. So here we have the birds, and it gets into a human, same thing. But the same human gets infected with a second variety of influenza. And we have a reassortment occurring in humans. And that then creates a new variety of virus. And notice in this little cartoon from the WHO, the receptor sites have changed. See that? The surface has changed. It's a mixture. We can have a reassortment occurring in pigs. Would that be why we call it swine flu? Yes. Okay, so we have a reassortment occurring in pigs. Pigs get the virus from birds and also get the virus from humans. We have co-infection, into that co-infection idea, two viruses in the same cell, and that results in coming about then with the new variety that comes back to humans. So reassortment from humans, reassortment from pigs. And then we can have a mutation occur in humans, just like we could have a mutation occur. And that again would relate to seasonal virus, point of mutation. One of the characteristics that we're seeing with the current H1N1 that we saw with the Spanish flu, 1918, is the ability to spread. Fortunately, the current flu is not lethal like the other. And you can see that after combat deaths and so on. But this little timeline at the bottom here, this little bit of data is interesting. March 11, 1918, military camp in Kansas. Company Cook came down with the flu. In 12 hours, 107 other people had it. By the second day, 500 and some had it. And in 1 week, it was discovered in all 50 states. That's the kind of thing we're talking about, spreading. Obviously, at this point in time, we have the H1N1 in every state. It's all over the country. Every county is reporting it. Every city has it. It's been around since last May, it's everywhere. If it was fatal like the 1918, we would have millions of people at risk of dying. Now, how effective is the vaccine that we create? Well, the military's got a very good system. I mean, they don't ask you whether you want the vaccine, they just tell you to report. And there may be a few people sneak by, but they're pretty good at it. And here we see this one ship, 40-some percent of the people came down with some degree of flu, even though 95% were immunized. But immunization is not 100% effective in preventing the flu. It does decrease deaths. It does result in a quicker immune response that's protective, but it doesn't necessarily result in a complete protection that avoiding that illness. Again, clinical features of the avian influenza now. Some interesting notes. Exposure to people who are sick, that's reasonable. Dead chickens, likely, that makes some sense. But all those people who go off and kill millions of chickens, who are all gowned up, if you've seen them, when there's an outbreak someplace in the Philippines or someplace in the world, and they kill off all the chickens, these people are the callers. And what's happening is that none of them ever got any, none of them ever came down with it. Now they are rubber boots, sprayed down with agents, detergents and so on, hand washing is good, they got masks on, etc., etc. So that tells us that you can break the chain of spread by not using superhuman means, but things like hand washing and covering your mouth when you sneeze and pop, these can be effective. But barring this is a highly infectious agent. Again, sustained fever, shortness of breath, dry, non-productive cough. That's going to be different than the normal flu. Progressing rapidly to chest change, X-ray changes, and the need for ventilation. The respirator. The body's immune response is a little unusual sometimes, and we get more of this in the beginning of the immune system, but a decrease in lymphocytes is a typical characteristic of a response to a viral infection. And here we see lymphocytopenia. Pneumonia means they drop in the number. Pneumonia means they drop in the number. Now this is another one of those, aren't we lucky that this is happening now? The normal kind of situation when we have the seasonal influenza, we know what the H1N1 variety, the H's and N's, are pretty much figured out in Asia first. And we figure those out 6 to 9 months ahead of time of when our season will be. So usually by May or so, we figure out what the common varieties are, and then we usually pick the top three. So we get the top three H's and N's. They're coming out of Asia. We have the summer to prepare, and we have most of the fall to immunize, because it's not going to hit us until November, December at the earliest, and then January, February being the highest. So we can immunize in September and October, the beginning of November, ahead of the seasonal flu, which is what we're doing now with the seasonal flu aspect. But if something comes along like the avian influenza or the current H1N1, time cycle is out of whack. The virus is coming in sooner. And as you can see, we're just now getting out with the vaccine, and we're getting the vaccine out, and the production is such that we're getting the vaccine out now, and we'll be a little bit more by mid-November, and most people will have had a chance to have the vaccine by Christmas, I would suspect. And by then, it may be waning away because that's when the seasonal flu should come in. So getting the seasonal flu shots now is the typical kind of thing, protecting you for later in the winter. But that's how long it takes us to do it. If we start today, it takes us a couple of months to get the viral prototype. When I was at that meeting in May, we had the viral prototype, I think by mid-May. We called it the seed strain. And we gave them out from the research aspect that went out into the commercial aspect for the companies to make it. Okay? So that took 1 to 2 months to develop. Then typically it takes us 1 to 2 months to develop that and then do some testing. Okay? And we did the testing for the H1N1 in August, July, August. And that's when we found out, you know, the children may need a second shot and all that sort of stuff came out, right? And we did the testing. That's the normal way we do it. And then it takes us a couple months to make a couple million doses. That's 6 months if we take the dose 2 months at a time. That's normal. Now, we're experiencing problems now with this new one. And remember, the H1N1 now is similar to the avian influenza, possibly in its infectivity. It's a different H's and N's, right? But it's similar in its infectivity. That is, how many people it affects. And what we see is that we're having a problem, not here. We got through this process fairly quickly. We had this by mid-May. But this process would have indicated that we should have it by July or August. It didn't. September. It didn't. October. We didn't. Okay? So this took a lot longer. And what's happening is our initial supply, we expected to get here by back in May. The estimate was, the meeting that came up, we should have this by mid-October. But what we had by mid-October, which is now about now, a little after, instead of being about 160 or 130 to 160 million units, that's what we estimated we'd have, we had someplace around 30 to 20 million units. Way off. Okay. Now, and that's partly because the production system was flawed, not flawed, but just not very efficient. The virus is killing off the cells that we're growing in, which is the eggs. We have to have lots and lots of eggs. So the egg farming is a good deal. Right? Lots and lots of fertilized eggs, and on the embryo, we grow it. You just take the egg, set it up like a shot glass kind of thing, put the egg up there. We cut a little patch off about a centimeter on the side, lift off the skin, and on the membrane underneath it, take that little membrane off. And below that is the embryo. Okay. And then we squirt in the virus, and then we put a little piece of tape over the top of it, and so it doesn't dry out. And then we incubate it in the regular incubator with a lot of humidity, because the humidity will send it to the shell of the egg and keep it alive. And then we harvest that. And then we do this by hand with millions of eggs. That's how we get it. But normally we get a lot of virus from every egg. And therefore we can dilute it out a great deal, and that will be an effective level that we can use. Now there's two varieties of the vaccine. There's a live attenuated, which is used for the nasal spray. The live attenuated variety is what's out earliest now. So when you see the children getting the spray up their nose, that's a live attenuated virus. Now for those who are concerned for all the wrong reasons about the addition of thimerosal or mercury as an additive to your vaccines, you mentioned that that's not related to autism, but everybody, not everybody, but there are those who think of it. There are parents who are concerned about it, and therefore they want it. Well, the live attenuated doesn't have that. Okay, so that's for that concern. It's not a real concern. That's a solution. Right? So you can use the live attenuated, and we're doing that with the younger children and so on. The actual H1N1 kill preparation, which is what we're going to make millions of units of, is just now getting shipped in boxes and moved out. So we're really slow in this process. And we still aren't at the point where we're dealing hundreds of millions of people. This is only the 20 to 30 million doses that we've got. We probably won't get to the 100 plus million mark for another month. And we won't get to the 300 million mark, that's the total population. We won't get to that probably at all, but we won't get to the several hundred million mark until maybe Christmas time. And by then, chances are, this one will be dying off. We don't know that for sure. It may linger longer. But in terms of getting a protective dose of the vaccine out in an effective manner, in a timely manner, this did not work. We are lucky in that this was not avian influenza. Okay. So the virologists and the public health people are not too concerned about this current one. But we basically have failed the test. If this was the real thing, if this had been a real avian influenza attack, then we would have hundreds of thousands of people dead since last May. And that didn't happen, fortunately, but our system is not working. What about all the Tamiflu on? There's not enough Tamiflu for everyone to get it when they need it, first off. Secondly, the more we use it, the more we won't be able to use it in the future. And thirdly, when the avian influenza comes, if it does come, there's no indication at this point in time that it'll even be affected by any of the current antivirals, let alone a specific one like Tamiflu. So this is not good news. This is, as it puts here, this is the optimistic approach. This is the best case scenario. 6 months. 6 months of uncontrolled infection in a population that killed people pretty bad. So, the influenza agent then is certainly a continual problem. And we can protect ourselves by doing very basic things. Hand washing, covering coughs, you are shedding the virus beginning about a day before your symptoms begin. So the person next to you may be shedding the virus right now. You shed the virus during the period of illness, which in the case of the current H1N1, the one that's going around now, that the current illness lasts somewhere between 4 and 7 days. And then you shed it for about 36 to 48 hours after the fever is gone. Now, the official number is 24 hours after the fever is gone. And that's sort of a compromise. A compromise for the idea that most people are okay after 24 hours, not everybody. And so, therefore, we sort of get people back to work maybe a little day sooner. But when you do this with millions of people, that's millions of work days that are saved. And so there's a calculation there to keep the economy going and all that sort of stuff. And so that means that you'll be out of school if you get it for about a week or so. It also means you're shedding. So if you are working in a pharmacy and people are coming in when they're sick to get their Tamiflu, then you're exposed to them. And if you are sick, and it just came back to work and the fever broke the other day and you feel a little bit better, you're still shedding most likely for the first 48 hours, 36 to 48 hours. Certainly the 1 day timeline after a fever, notice that after a fever, after you stop taking anti-fever kind of compounds. So it's not just something the fever broke, it's not no longer needs to be controlled by anti-fever. At the bottom here now we have, we talked about the epidemiology spreading around the world, person to person. We talked about the vaccine, with the live attenuated that we're using, but we also have the killed preparation, which is the vast majority. By the way, again, with the killed preparation, there are some that don't, some small amounts of vaccines, and this is all vaccines, all the shots of immunization. Small amounts are available that don't have the thimerosal in it, that don't have full mercury in it. Can be gotten on special order with racial aid and all that sort of stuff. But again, that's giving in to the post-hoc ergo proximus idea. It follows, therefore, it's caused by this no causal link between autism and immunization. And so it's a nod in that direction, even though we don't need to do it. The vast majority of injectable pill preparations have some sort of antibacterial agent in it to prevent infection. It would be foolish that we would immunize someone against the virus and at the same time give them a staph infection. That would not be good. So we don't see that because we have things like Thymidol. Okay, let's talk about Guillain-Barré and Reye syndrome. Guillain-Barré syndrome. Guillain-Barré syndrome occurs in a small percentage of the population when exposed to the virus. It is an immune response to the virus that cross-reacts with the myelin sheath, peripheral nervous system. And as a result, you destroy sections of the myelin sheath. And that then interferes with nerve transmission, the impulse. Therefore, we end up with weakness or paralysis, usually of an arm or a leg or something like that. Usually it's transitory. That is, it will last for anywhere from 1 or 2 weeks to maybe 4 to 6 months. It gradually gets better. A small number of people with Guillain-Barré will develop respiratory tract paralysis, requiring them to be on a ventilator. Until they get better. Some people will not get on the ventilator fast enough and will die. This is when exposed to the virus in any of its forms, including immunization. Now, one of the problems we're currently experiencing with the development of vaccines has to do with the 1976 outbreak of what was then called swine flu and H1N1. And we immunized about 100 million people in 1976. The best guess is about four or five people came down with H1N1. Four or five. Some guesses are a little bit too many. But we immunized 108 people. And when we developed ENVA in that setting, it was because we immunized a great number of people. Now, had we had a major epidemic or the flu, then most of the people would have got it because of actual getting exposed to the virus. But it wasn't that way. Now, in the United States, when something bad happens, and about 1,100 people died, when something bad happens, we sue. So if somebody died after receiving the immunization, and it was a Guillain-Barré, and we can say that that is a possibility, particularly back in the 1976 varieties of vaccines. We have cleaned them up a little bit, and we think it's less of a concern now, and so we don't see it as often in terms of the vaccines, but it was a problem back then. A very small, tiny problem. Okay. Immunized 100 million people, 1,100 died. Now, the problem was we sued the companies then turned to the federal government and said, well, you know, we have a license to produce this vaccine, and the license says that you're going to indemnify us, that is, you're going to pay the lawsuit. But the federal government said, nah, I don't know. So by the time these lawsuits hit the bank account of the drug companies, we're now in the 80s, and the federal government is backing away from doing things of a national level. They want to make the government smaller and all that kind of good stuff. And in that era, we decided not to identify those who we spoke to deal with. So the drug company says, fine, we're out of the business. This is a liability, and we only get 50 cents a shot. And this is not worth the effort. The profit margin on drugs is 5,000%. Why should we worry about pennies when we can make thousands of dollars? So they said, we don't need to do this. So from the 1980s on, as the various licenses for the various vaccines expired, nobody picked them up anymore. Nobody in the United States did. So the vast majority of the capacity to produce vaccines is not in the United States. So it's like we talk about the disappearing manufacturing base in the United States. Well, there's a disappearing pharmaceutical base in the United States. There's a disappearing vaccine production base in the United States. We figure, well, if we need it, we'll just buy it. And guess what? When there's a worldwide epidemic, and everybody in the world wants it, and the people in France are making it, or the people in Germany are making it, who do you think gets it first? Maybe the people in France or Germany? Yeah. So we don't get it when we'd like to get it. The same thing with making Tamiflu and so on. Many of these compounds are not made in the United States. Or if they are made in the United States, it's a small capacity compared to what we need. Even respirators. And we tend to think the United States, you know, we're going to help the rest of the world, we're going to give them the vaccine, we're going to give them the Tamiflu, we have so much in the reserve, we're going to give them masks, and give them respirators, we got so much. Wrong. We are out there getting it from them, the rest of the world. China is making various machines and respirators, we have to get on the open market. So that all began with vaccines. So by the time we decided to go into Desert Storm 1 and then Desert Storm 2 with Bush 1 and Bush 2 and all that kind of stuff. When we send soldiers out, we have to immunize them. We didn't have enough stock of immunizing agents to immunize our soldiers. We actually had a delayed war by 6 to 8 months at a time. Oh, it's for a big buildup. No, one of the reasons why we couldn't protect them against various things that are known to be protected against vaccines. So we have a problem. Our capacity to produce, not the research, we still got the guys that developed the vaccine. So I said, we knew about the H1N1, the current one. We knew about it in May. We had the seed strains out by mid-May, 13th, 15th of May, something like that. They come out. We gave them out to all the companies. And they've been sitting on it since then. And it doesn't take, when you infect an egg, it doesn't take months. I mean, how long does an egg last? 7 days or so? I mean, the embryo is only there for a little while, and it either becomes a chicken or dies or something, right? And so we can't sit on this egg, so to speak, for long. We have to inoculate it and get it moving. We couldn't do that fast enough. Our capacity, the number of millions of eggs and the people that make it, just isn't here. And if we have any production problem where the virus is not producing, the egg is not producing a lot of virus, and therefore we can't dilute it out as much as we had before, we have a delivery problem. And that's what we're experiencing right now. And then you couple that by saying, oh, by the way, we also want you to protect against seasonal flu. It's the same guys. The same people are making both kinds of vaccines. Now, we are trying to move away from eggs. We're trying to move into cell cultures. We're not there yet. We actually have chicken cell cultures. You would think that would be a logical, why don't we do that? It hasn't worked. Living eggs seems to be the best way to do it. And until we develop a cell culture system that can be automated, we have a problem. And it all began with Guillain-Barré syndrome. So, is Guillain-Barré syndrome a problem with the current vaccine? We don't think so. Okay. I think we've straightened it out. And this is a big test now. If we immunize 100 million people, we'll find out if this is a big problem or not. One reason why we don't think so is because we're so late in getting the vaccine out, we've already got 100 million people infected, and it's not a big issue. Okay. So the actual infecting agent, which should trigger it, isn't triggering a big problem either. So we think we're okay this time around for Guillain-Barré. But remember, we come about with both infection as well as immunization. And it's an immune response to the myelin sheath that results in weakness of an arm or a leg up to paralysis of an arm or a leg that can last anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 months. And in severe situations, it can start to paralysis and you need a respirator. This would go back to a discussion about our genetics. Probably in the future, how far down the road, I don't know, 20 years, let's say, we'll have enough genetic profile, we'll know who's at risk. But it is the way your immune response responds, so it is up to you, and we might be able to detect that. What was in the vaccine? They tried to remove, and this takes a little bit of time, they tried to remove some of the agents that are the nervous system of the chick that might get in the vaccine. So they tried to separate more of the virus. Remember, the virus is growing, and as the virus grows, it's going to be a budding release, so it's going to take things from the host cell with it. And if it's invading the tissue in the process of getting it from the infected embryo, if we get a little bit more of the embryo itself and not so much just virus, then we might get some of that. Okay? So we can clean that aspect of it up, but our bigger problem is just getting enough vaccine out. Second problem, Reye syndrome. Reye syndrome is also an immune-based problem. So just like Guillain-Barré, which comes about, as you get better and you have an immune response. If Guillain-Barré doesn't occur initially, it occurs, about 2 weeks after your illness when your immune response is at the max. Reye syndrome is the same way. Reye syndrome appears about 2 weeks after you've got your initiation of the illness. In Reye syndrome, we have an immune-based problem, but we're not exactly certain how it comes about. It's an interesting lesson in biochemistry. Because what happens is that the mitochondria are in some ways damaged, which means then the patient isn't producing sufficient levels of ATP. Now, how this comes about, we're not certain. We think that there's a cofactor involved. So you need the infection. And the infection could be with influenza virus. It could be with chickenpox virus. It could be with measles virus. So several viruses may trigger it. And in conjunction to the viral infection, there's a correlation with the presence of aspirin or aspirin-containing compound, as well as a possible correlation with various insecticides and herbicides. So chemical cofactors seems to be involved. So we need an experience of the virus and having an immune response. And the virus can be influenza virus, but also can be chickenpox virus or measles virus. and a cofactor of some sort of chemical nature. Aspirin being a leading compound. And aspirin meaning aspirin and aspirin-containing compounds. And Pepto-Bismol may have an aspirin-containing compound. So various kinds of aspirin-containing compounds. So that's why we tell children with a fever, don't give them aspirin. It's to avoid Reye syndrome. So once we have this damage and we're not sure why, again, in response to her question earlier, there is some possible genetic link. And once we have more about the human genome, we can go out there, maybe we can figure out who would be at risk. But nonetheless, we have an impaired mitochondria, and that means it's not really enough ATP. So now the body begins to do things. The body begins to think, well, maybe we don't have enough glucose. So the liver goes into gluconeogenesis. Remember that? Gluconeogenesis in the liver. Since that's not the problem, it doesn't get to an end point. That is, it doesn't solve the problem, so it continues and continues. And eventually we damage the liver, and we have the development of fat globules upon biopsy of the liver. We call it fatty liver syndrome, which is typical of some toxic effect on the liver. Fatty liver syndrome. And you can see the fat globule problem right on the biopsy. So the liver is not doing well. First they go to liver failure. Lack of ATP, the muscle decides, well, we're going to help out. We're going to use lactic acid fermentation, a backup of aerobic respiration. We don't normally think of ourselves as being facultative anaerobes, but at a small level, we are. So if you begin to run a marathon and get about 50 feet outside the door, and you stop to, quote, catch your breath, what does that mean? It means you're not producing enough ATP to move your mass of cells down the road. Okay. You're not a very efficient machine. If you look at someone who runs marathons, or even have ultra marathons, you ever heard of ultra marathons? They run 100 miles. It takes them a day and a half or so. Their toenails fall off, and their kidneys get messed up because they're jumping up and down, and they pee out a lot. You can run 100 miles. There's only brief stopping for, basically, they stop when the center to see if their blood pressure is fine and everything else, not going to die on the road someplace. And they're running in the dark, they're running in the day, they're running and running alone. Why do they do that? They keep running, and everybody stops to catch their breath. Well, what happens is that these people have a balance between their production of ATP and their use of ATP. Most people, if you increase your need for ATP, you don't produce enough of it, and you have to stop. You have to catch your breath, which means we have to convert the lactic acid buildup in our muscle, which results in fatigue and so on. Lactic acid and acidosis is building up because that's the backup system the muscle is using. So producing lactic acid as part of lactic acid fermentation. So we have lactic acid, we have acidosis in the bloodstream, and then if you have that, you have then the Hitzenhausenbeck equation, you have it over here. Hitzenhausenbeck equation, pH of the blood, and respiration rates, and all that kind of stuff. So what's happening is the patient is in great need of ATP so that we have lactic acid being used, and the patient in the hospital bed now, not running on the road, goes into acidosis. That also is not good for them, right? Which then, of course, affects the respiration rate. Well, we still haven't solved the problem from the damaged ATP. Well, areas of the body that need to have lots of ATP include the lining of the brain. We talk about the blood-brain barrier. It's an interesting term. It is maintained by a high level of ATP there, but when we have inflammation, like when you want to treat somebody with meningitis, the inflamed lining of the brain is much more permeable than a normal lining of the brain, which works to our advantage because that's when we try to cross it with antimicrobial agents. Okay. But nonetheless, we're trying to maintain the blood-brain barrier. It's not being maintained well. Fluid builds up in the brain, and the brain begins to swell because of the lack of ATP. And usually, that's going to result in the death of the patient. If the brain swells up against the heart inside the cranium, and then you have damage done. We're actually learning a lot about this because of the roadside bomb. Okay? The brain gets shaken inside the skull, resulting in all kinds of damage. It swells, and then you have brain damage. And what we do patient with Reye syndrome, just like we do in the soldier with the concussion of that nature, is we take off part of the skull and allow it to swell out. Sounds rather gross, but that's what happens. Okay. And then we gradually, when the brain starts getting back into normal osmotic balance, then we can put down the skull or put in the plate or something like that. So this really requires someone who is an expert in liver function, an expert in brain function, maybe a neurosurgeon, and internal medicine. It's a team of physicians that need to treat this Reye syndrome patient. So what we basically do is we tell the parents not to use aspirin because we think it's a factor, but we're not exactly certain what the mechanism is. If children have a fever, we can avoid it. If someone has had recent infection with a virus such as influenza, measles, chickenpox, in about 2 weeks or so, when they're getting better, they then start having brain function problems. That is, they become very sleepy, very tired, unconscious. You know what we're talking about. We then immediately rush them not to the local doctor's office, that's just in passing, not to the local hospital, that's just to get to the helicopter. We then send you to a Reye Center, in which there are several in the state, where we have a team that we call Whatnot, and the team comes to deal with that patient. Because someone's going to have to take a liver biopsy on this child, we're going to have to do spinal taps on the child, we may have to get the neurosurgeon to open up the skull. All this has to be done over the next few hours, maybe certainly in the next few days. We don't want the local physician trying to handle this. Because by the time they handle it and then pass it on, it's much worse. So that's Reye syndrome. Factors in the virus, the triggers, we're not sure. Factors that are cofactors, such as aspirin and so on, we're not sure of the mechanism either. Fortunately, the caution about fever in children and not using aspirin seems to penetrate the population at a very high level. And the viruses that we are seeing in those categories, we're immunizing against and so on, as much as possible, measles, of course, and chickenpox now. And we're seeing less cases of Reye. But we're not certain that we're seeing less cases of Reye because the virus has changed or we are better at protecting ourselves against taking aspirin and so on. It's just not there as much. So we did all the right things we thought, but we didn't have an underlying mechanism to prove it, and then the problem seems to disappear. So we're saying, see, we knew what we were doing, but we don't. Okay. So it could come back as a problem. And so we avoid the use of aspirin acetaminophen compounds in children with a fever to avoid this. Yes?
So you said this is mostly kids, or can this happen to anybody?
No, it's mostly children. Mostly children. But the use of other compounds, ibuprofen and so on, in everybody just becomes the natural way to do it. Ibuprofen works with a different mechanism than typical aspirin. Cytomegalovirus, CMV. This virus is an agent that can cause pneumonia. Can cause encephalitis, can cause eye infections, a retinitis. It can affect the cornea, the corneal infection as well. And can affect the conjunctiva, keratoconjunctivitis. So it can cause lots of different problems. But typically, it only causes anything that's remotely severe in immunocompromised patients. So this is one that we see primarily with immunocompromised patients. So AIDS patients, for example, great risk of getting CMV, cytomegalovirus, getting a serious infection. Now, CMV also causes a mild problem, not needing particular treatment for any sort, a mild problem in otherwise healthy people. I call it mini-mono. Mini-mono. It gives the symptoms of mononucleosis because it's a sexually transmitted disease as well. Get that? How about that? So the STD as well. So So it's spread by droplet by other means as well. So here we have this sexually transmitted disease that affects then college-age students. And we come down with people who think they have mono, but when they do the test for Epstein-Barr virus, the agent that causes mononucleosis, it comes up negative. And so it runs its course usually in about 2 to 3 weeks. If you feel particularly run down and so on, you get the mononucleosis test for Epstein-Barr virus, and it comes up negative, but by that point in time, you're getting better. So it's not a major health problem on healthy people, but it becomes a serious life-threatening infection in the lungs, the lining of the brain, parts of the eye, and so on, for immunocompromised patients. Fungal infection. Remember, we're dealing with eukaryotic cells. Remember that we are eukaryotic cells. Therefore, the treatment is going to be complicated because of we sharing targets with the organism. Coccidioides timidus, Cryptococcus neoformans, and Aspergillus species. The first one there, Coccidioides timidus. It's also known as San Joaquin Valley fever or desert fever. I mentioned this in passing before. You inhale the spores that grow in the soil in certain climatic conditions, i.e. San Joaquin Valley or desert fever. And you inhale the spores of the fungal organism. Most people will produce both an antibody response and a cell-mediated immune response quickly within 2 weeks. And it will be then protected. So most people will get a dry cough for a few days, slight fever, nothing serious, and move on. A small number of individuals, however, whose immune system seems to be blinded by this with respect to a cell-mediated immune response, produces an antibody response only. And the antibody response only is not protective. These patients will develop a full-blown pneumonia. This is going to be an interstitial pneumonia, as opposed to an alveolar pneumonia. And can result in debilitating illness. It can last for weeks, months, and can result in death. The antifungal agents that we use, like amphotericin B and the like, have serious consequences in terms of kidney problems and so on. And as a result, we don't like to use them for long term. So we sort of use them with the patient and take them off for a little while to see if their CMI response comes back online. And if that doesn't, we use more of the drug and then you take them back to work. You don't like to keep them on for long periods of time. If you don't convert, you often die. The mechanism of converting from an antibody response to a CMI response has to do with cytokines that we'll talk about details when we talk about the immune response, and we'll remind you of coccidioides timidus at that point in time. Cryptococcus neoformans is a common agent. In this case, we're not too concerned as much with the spores, but what's happening is we are spraying from person to person the yeast form of the organism that has a capsule. Remember, these are dimorphic. They are mold-producing spores, which is what we saw spreading in the case of coccidioides timidus. But here at Cryptococcus, what we're seeing is spreading from patient to patient is the yeast form with a capsule. And this encapsulated is a sugar capsule, which is antiphagocytic, and so it causes a pneumonia much like the same you would see with a bacterial pneumonia. So this will be more likely to be an alveolar kind of problem as opposed to interstitial. And people at risk for this would be children from about 3 months of age to about 5 years of age, and immunocompromised adults. So Cryptococcus neoformans, an example of a fungal agent that has a capsule in its yeast form that causes pneumonia and alveolar pneumonia in patients that are typical risk groups, such as children from 3 months of age. years of age and immunocompromised adult. Aspergillus. Now, aspergillus agent, you're exposed to the spores of the mold form, and this mold form is the basic agent that you see that grows in the grout in the shower. Different colors, Aspergillus niger is black, and it's you can see it in the grout in the showers. You inhale the spores, and you have sort of like an allergic reaction, sometimes called a pneumonitis as opposed to a pneumonia. We won't make that big a distinction, but it's more of an allergic reaction or a pneumonitis. And this will be scattered throughout the lung and trigger an interstitial kind of response. So scattered throughout the lung. So a chest x-ray of this will show you massive amount of inflammation. That's the typical kind of exposure. There are aspergillus species that grow in silos for corn and so on. Sometimes it's called farmer's lung. You get this chronic infection, chronic reaction, like an allergic reaction in the lung. This is what we see in the problems associated with flood victims, and you see the houses in New Orleans still aren't back online years after Katrina. And when we go there, anybody volunteer, people have masks on and stuff, best to avoid this. The mold grows amazingly fast in a moist, warm climate. So wherever the water was, there'll be mold. And then shortly thereafter, people will be all over the inside. That's why you don't see people fixing these houses. Because the mold will be in the wood, behind the wall, and so you have to tear it all down to the cement basement, that's where you go in the basement, cement slab for the most part. If you dig a hole in your lane, it fills up with water. So basically you have a flat slab that they put on with the house on. You basically tear it down to the slab. And everything else is infected in a sense. Everything else is contaminated with aspergillus. And it results in serious health hazards to people who live in that area.
Is that because they waited so long to clean it up, or just like the...
No. And that's normal. Within a week or so of having a flood, it's everywhere. So this would be anywhere, for example. If they have a particularly warm climate, then it's a little bit better than if you have a flood in the middle of winter in North Dakota or something like that. But if you let that one go into North Dakota in the spring came, then you're a little bit. Bacterial agents of lower respiratory tract problems. Well, the first two up there are quite obvious. Pounds that into your cream, I think, fairly effectively. That is, organisms that capsules cause pneumonia and infection. Right? And so we have Streptococcus pneumoniae, Haemophilus influenzae. Capsules, they have vaccines that are created because they have sugar put in capsules. Vaccine, sugar water. And these agents are the common agents that would follow on the heels of a viral infection. So when we talk about the 1918 epidemic, we had two kinds of patients. We have those patients that die because of the respirator is needed and they die in 4 days. And then we have the normal flu people that we have that get the seasonal flu, and we're talking about the extremes of age. The elderly population. And in that population, we're looking for a secondary bacterial infection. So they get the viral pneumonia, that may kill them, but the bacterial pneumonia that follows is definitely going to put a hurt on them. Okay. So we want to immunize in the flu season. We want to make certain that we immunize the elderly population against particularly streptococcus pneumonia to prevent the bacterial infection. Now, occasionally, physicians will be using antibacterial agents in these patients. They're not trying to treat the virus, but they are trying to prevent the bacterial infection. It's a sloppy way of doing it. because you don't know that every patient's going to be at risk. So that's sort of a sloppy way. It can be an effective for an individual patient, but it's probably not an effective strategy overall. It's probably best to immunize the patient against both the viral infection as well as the bacterial infections, and that way they're protected better. But we can, in some settings, you'll see the use of antibacterial agents during the problem of the viral infection, particularly in certain places like nursing homes and so on, where we have a cluster of high-risk patients. But these are all reasonably treatable. Dr. Namoli, only recently, in the last 10 years or less, became a problem relative to treatment with penicillin compounds. We'll get more about that later. Haemophilus influenzae is negative, so obviously typical penicillin won't work. We talked about Haemophilus influenzae earlier with the colitis. But there are broad-spectrum compounds that will work with Haemophilus. So the treatment of these is not particularly a problem yet. There are agents that we can use. And it should be understood then, if we're producing an antibody that's an opsonizing antibody, that is the same antibody that the mother has plenty of, and so that the baby for the first 3 months is protected. So we don't see bacterial pneumonias leading to bacterial meningitis in a typical healthy 1-month-old child. The mother should have sufficient levels of antibody protection. After 3 months, though, after decreasing from 3 months, 3 months being the highest incidence, and gradually getting better in terms of less incidence up to the age of about 5 years of age, that's when the baby is at greatest risk. Okay, but that's often when the couple with the new baby gets cabin fever, and at 3 and 4 months, they take the baby to the grocery store with them, they go to Meijer or something, and the baby's sitting there in the little seat thing sideways, sitting there, and they're over there getting vegetables and cereal and stuff, and a total stranger comes up and picks the baby up and hugs them, and I've got a granddaughter in Oklahoma. So what? Why do I care about that? You're grabbing my kid. What are you doing? So they're exposing their kids to agents at that point in time, and they'd be better off if they were going to do that, to do it right when the baby was born. The baby is much more protected then against bacterial infections in the first 3 months than it is in month 5 and 6. One little note about Streptococcus pneumoniae. There are many, many, many serotypes of the capsules involved, over 20. And we put the sugars in the vaccine. When we expose the body to 20 different sugars, we don't respond equally to all of them. And therefore, some people respond to certain ones, and others respond to other ones. Somebody responds to everything, but nobody responds to all things. And so you sort of pick and choose. We call this immune dominance. And each one will pick the ones that they think the most important to respond to. That means even though you've been exposed to all 20-some, you may not be equally protected for all 20-some varieties. So repeated immunization in the elderly population is not a bad thing. We do that boostering with the elderly population, everybody 65 on. So just once is usually not sufficient. Doesn't mean we have to do it every year, but we do it every couple of years, trying to stimulate those second and third chances. What happens then is the ones you responded to heavily the first time, you do that again, but now you start seeing some of the other ones you missed the first time. Again, immune dominance. We have this problem where we have lots of agents in one vaccine. To help out with that, we put in proteins. Proteins there are to help stimulate your T cells to be more efficient in responding to the sugar. Proteins that we put into those vaccines are not to stimulate the immune response to the protein in terms of an antibody or lymphocyte response, but rather to help us stimulate a stronger response to the antibody. The Germans call it Schlepper, which is a German-Yiddish term for a helper. And so these Schlepper proteins, these helpers, are the proteins that are helping the body respond to the sugar. This is by far from perfect. And so when we add more and more agents into a single immunization, we start seeing more and more of this immune dominance. our first little encounter with that is with streptococcus pneumonia, because we keep finding new sugars that the organism produces different sugars. Not so much with cocktail pneumonia, excuse me, not so much with the mottled pneumonia, more with streptococcus pneumonia. Klebsiella pneumoniae. This is an unusual agent. It has a capsule. It's often associated with your GI tract. It's a gram-negative organism. So we have a gram-positive, and now we have a second gram-negative. As we talk about these, which ones are gram-positive and gram-negative, make note of it. It's from my point of view, it's sort of a one-hit-two-duck thing. But from your point of view, in about a year, it's going to be an essential piece of information. So not for this class, but for all of them. Because as you know, if the organism is a gram-positive organism, the murine layer is exposed, and the different variety of antibacterial drugs that you can use. If it's a gram-negative, the murine layer is buried in the lipid polysaccharide layer, and you have to have a variety of drugs that will penetrate through that lipid layer. Well, the selection of drug is significantly impacted on whether it's a gram-positive, gram-negative, or of course the acid fast. So, as we talk about them, make note of it so you're aware of it. The Klebsiella pneumoniae is a gram-negative organism found in the GI tract, and it's an unusual agent to cause a respiratory tract problem. And usually what happens is there's something unusual about the patient. We can have the spinal fluid involved in a spina bifida patient, those are open spine patients. And so we have the lower portion of the spine is not completely closed, it's a developmental problem, often associated with the lack of folic acid during pregnancy, during fetal development. And we've had embryology, the neural tube closure is not as it should be. And so we see the spina bifida patients occurring. And as a result, then, that diaper associated with fecal material is awfully close to the open spine area and it's easy to get contaminated. It then goes into the spinal fluid, causing a bacteremia, causing not only a meningitis of this organism, but also pneumonia. So it's sort of an unusual agent in that respect. So it's not this typical aspiration kind of thing that we saw with streptococcus pneumonia muffled simply breathing in the organism. Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas is another gram-negative organism, and this is a particularly nasty bug. If we're going to give a bug, a bacterial agent, a status of king of the bee species, this would be it. This organism is typically found in soil, and it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. So it's found in soil. It doesn't produce spores or anything like that. Remember, spores are gram-positive, broad, Clostridium bacillus organisms and so on. This is not causing spores. It's just a tough bug. It can grow and survive in the cold. It can grow in minimal media. It has lots and lots of exoenzymes, so it can digest its environment. And it can be isolated in extremely minimal environment. We mentioned before it might be found in distilled water in a hospital, distilled water system in a hospital that had algal contamination and so on. The organism uses a Stickland reaction and such. So it's really, really efficient in surviving in minimal media. But it also really, really, really well when you get a lot of food. So it survives close to the soil. So anything associated with soil can have this organism. Take this idea into the hospital. Take this idea into the carpet in the hospital. People walk in, they've got dirt on their shoes. Who figured that one out, right? And so now we have the organisms in the carpet in the hospital. The organism is in the cafeteria in the hospital. Tomatoes, lettuce, okay? Where does that come from? Soil, right? Do they autoclave the lettuce? I don't think so, right? And so therefore there's organisms on this in the salad. Pseudomonas is in the cafeteria. This organism can invade the smallest location. There was a went to this meeting and this fellow had just come back from his ward and he taught that he worked in an infectious unit that had a burn unit in it in West Virginia, and they lost something like 5 patients in a short period of time at the burn unit with Pseudomonas. The organism got to that unit, not in the flowers, of course it's not with flowers in the room, soil, flowers, no brainer, but also it was under the aluminum foil flap for the orange juice.
plant is lift up, put the straw in, and they're there. All you need is a small exposure to immunosuppress patient, and we got a problem. Burn patients are certainly a problem. In this case, Pseudomonas in the lungs is associated with an improperly maintained positive pressure breathing apparatus. Respiratory therapy. A patient who's got a problem in their lungs, maybe they have asthma or something, maybe they don't even have an infectious problem, but they have a problem in their lungs, and maybe we're just giving them salt water. Okay? But we can also deliver drugs that way as well, right? Maybe we're just giving them salt water. But the apparatus itself has to be taken apart and maintained by the respiratory therapist. If it's not properly maintained, this organism will grow. It'll grow on plastic. It'll grow on carbonic acid. It will break down the plastic and carbonic acid. There are isolates of Pseudomonas that are used to eat up oil slicks. In the Middle East, they have problems with Pseudomonas growing inside these large, maybe 3 to 5 foot diameter pumping stations. And we have the big tankers, come right up to the shore, but too deep. About a mile out of shore, they have a pumping station. Now, to get it from the shore to the pumping station, they have these big pipes under the ocean. And these pipes are 3 to 5 feet in diameter. Pseudomonas can infect the pipes to the point where it creates a clog. Right? It's eating the oil. It's certainly going to eat plastic. Eat, meaning produces extra enzymes. So it can grow in the positive pressure breathing apparatus. Not simply contaminating on the surface. It's thriving there. Okay? So now you have the patient breathing in deeply Pseudomonas. This can't be a good idea. And of course, once it gets inside the lung, it has all the exoenzymes that it uses to break down things in the soil and then deposit the breathing apparatus and start breaking down the patient. Lots and lots of exoenzymes. So here we have an organism that easily got into the hospital. What do you think its antimicrobial resistance pattern is? Massive. Okay. Multiple antibiotic resistance. Lots and lots of R factors. R factors with all kinds of resistances. Resistance to the antimicrobial agents, resistance to the various disinfecting agents. It thrives in this environment. There are isolates on occasion that we'll see in a hospital that we have no known treatment for. Can't treat it. Super rough. I mean, it makes MRSA look like a child in kindergarten. Okay? So, fortunately, it's not that common that has the untreatable category. But it can occur. So Pseudomonas is a big, bad bug. When we get this in the hospital setting, we get it in an immunocompromised patient, it's a serious infection. Easily in the lungs, easily bloodstream infection, easily causing brain problems, wherever. So Pseudomonas, particularly nasty organism to deal with. Again, another grand thing. And Staph aureus, the last one for today. Staph aureus. This organism is found in the upper respiratory tract. Normal flora, in a sense. Now, there are varieties of Staph aureus that cause infections there, but many of the varieties do not, and they can cause just a colonization in the upper respiratory tract. Now, we'll go into more detail a little later. Staph aureus has an enzyme that causes plasma to clot, called coagulase. It causes plasma, a fraction of blood. Plasma to clot. So it has an enzyme called coagulase. And that's a big, big bifurcation. There are isolates of Staph aureus that cannot do that, and isolates that can. And those who can are much more virulent. It's not simply because of the coagulase, but there's related genetic elements that increase the virulence. So we have coagulase positive Staph aureus, and then we have the smaller ones, more number, coagulase negative Staph aureus, more number of isolates. And there's even another species, Staphylococcus epidermidis, which is always coagulase negative. So the coagulase negative staph include those isolates of Staph aureus and that are coagulase negative, probably mutants from the normal organism. And then we have Staphylococcus epidermidis on the skin epidermis, and that organism then is always coagulase negative. So the coagulase positive ones are much more harder to treat, more virulence, more likely to cause disease than the coagulase negatives. But these staph that we have in your nose can be of either variety. and they generally don't get in the lungs. Except, of course, if you aspirate vomit. So when someone drinks too much, your roommate maybe, not you, right? And they throw up into the toilet, and it comes out their nose, and they're coughing and choking. It's also, they're aspirating some of that. Okay? And as they aspirate it, it's rinsing out the staph aureus and the upper respiratory tract, and it can get into the lungs. When we see Staphylococcus aureus causing pneumonia, we immediately think this is someone who's aspirated vomit, and they're likely an alcoholic or a drug abuser. They've been vomiting and they've been aspirating for vomit. They've been rinsing out the upper respiratory tract and aspirating, breathing it in. Now, of course, if you breathe in vomit, which has a low pH, that also causes damage to the lungs as well. So when we see a certain patient with a certain kind of problem, if we see someone with Streptococcus pneumonia, Mofus and Poenzi, okay, we understand how that can happen. If we see Klebsiella pneumoniae, Pseudomonas, or Staph aureus, something else about that patient puts them at risk. We need to know what that is. Because if it's in a hospital setting and Pseudomonas, maybe the positive pressure breathing apparatus that they're using right now in the room is spreading it to another person. We need to find it out. Okay? Next time.